That's John chapter 13, page 1081. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I've done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them."
Jen, thanks so much indeed for reading. Let me add my welcome. My name is Simon Dowdy, and I'm the vicar here at St. Botolph's. Welcome to our Remembrance Day service. As we consider this question, is Christianity good for Britain? Now, you may have seen the headlines a few months ago, "Toxic Brands. Britons say religion does more harm than good." A poll suggested that nearly two-thirds of Britons believe that religion causes more harm than it brings benefits. And certainly it's fair to say, I think, that to call yourself a Christian in contemporary Britain is to invite pity, condescension, or cool dismissal. In his book Unapologetic, the author Francis Spufford describes the welter of prejudice that the admission of Christian belief tends to unleash. He writes, "It means that we believe in a load of Bronze Age absurdities. It means that we don't believe in dinosaurs. It means we're dogmatic, that we're self-righteous, that we advocate wishy-washy niceness, that we promise the oppressed pie in the sky when they die, that we destroy the spontaneity and hopefulness of children by implanting a sick mythology in young minds." So our question this Remembrance Day service, is Christianity good for Britain, is an important one. And I want to argue that at its heart, Christianity is good for Britain because the death of Jesus Christ on the cross lies at the very heart of the Christian faith, of authentic Christianity, which means that the centre of the Christian faith is service of others rather than the accumulation of power for oneself. I take it that couldn't be more relevant given the massive breakdown in trust in British society as a result of the way in which power has repeatedly been abused and misused. I guess you might say it started, or perhaps was clarified, with the Profumo scandal back in the 1960s, which opened the eyes of many to the hypocrisy of politicians. Trust was further eroded with the Tory sleaze of the 1990s and then the more recent expenses scandal. The faith that the public then invested overwhelmingly in Tony Blair was squandered by invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And as we look at the sort of landscape of our country, it seems that no institution has been left unscathed. So the abuse scandals have rocked the BBC, many churches and local authorities. The police even are routinely assumed to lie. The abuse and misuse of power. By contrast, at the heart of genuine Christianity lies not the accumulation of power, but the service of others. And I want us, just in the next few minutes, to look again at that reading which we had. So if you close your Bible, please do turn to John chapter 13 on page 1081. And I just want us to see two very simple things this lunchtime. I've put them there on the outline on the service sheet. The first is that the death of Jesus in the service of others. Secondly, the disciples of Jesus in the service of others. So first of all then, the death of Jesus in the service of others. And I want us to appreciate the enormous shock and surprise of this reading from John chapter 13. Have a look at verse 1. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. It's just before the arrest and crucifixion of Jesus. That will happen just in a few hours' time. In verse 3, we're reminded of Jesus' identity and mission. Just look down to the next paragraph. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Jesus knows that he has power over everything in creation. He knows he's come from God to reveal to us what God is like. And now he is returning to God, to heaven, from where he'll rule the universe. What's more, look on to verse 13, towards the end of our reading, where Jesus says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am." Is that not staggering? The most staggering of claims. No other religious teacher or prophet has dared make such a claim, because, of course, if it were not true that Jesus was not only teacher but also Lord, the Lord, then it would be blasphemy. You see, genuine Christianity is not about power play, but the facts of history. I take it that we are suspicious, aren't we, of rival belief systems competing with each other, so to speak, for their share of the market. But you see, at the heart of the Christian faith, at the heart of authentic Christianity, is that Jesus Christ, who is fully God, came down from God, died and rose again, never then to die again, and rose back to heaven from where he came. No other religion makes the claim. If true, it means Christianity is completely unique, because it means that you and I do not have to guess for ourselves or try and work out for ourselves what God is like. He's come to earth to show us what he is like. But notice, and I think even more staggering, is what Jesus Christ then does with his authority. Have a look at verse 4. "So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him." He adopts the dress code of a slave. And as they're about to eat this meal, he washes his disciples' feet. In the first century, that was a regular custom. If you went to someone's house, the streets were filthy, and so the job of the slave was to wash the feet of visitors. I'm told if you go to Yotmal in India, there's a college there that trains people to be church leaders. And that if you go to Union Seminary and enter the main courtyard, there's a statue which echoes the enormous shock and surprise of what is going on here in John chapter 13. The focus of the statue is a tall, dignified man, someone who we might see and automatically identify as an important religious person. And he's obviously worthy of respect, because hunched before him on the floor is a menial slave. And anyone just looking at that statue, a Hindu or a Christian in India, would accept this is right and proper. Until that is, they see the inscription underneath, which simply reads, "Jesus washing Peter's feet. It is breathtaking, isn't it? Someone with all authority and all power as a servant of others. It is an acted parable. It's an illustration of what Jesus' death will achieve. Just have a look at Peter's response, verse 6. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." You see, Peter's reply is simply at the level of what is socially acceptable. But Jesus replies at the level of symbolism. Verse 8, Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." What does this washing mean? Well, it's a picture of the washing away of sin, the washing away of all our wrongdoing against God. In fact, Jesus may well here be drawing from Psalm 51 back in the Old Testament. Let me just read part of it to you. I've had it printed. It's there on the order of service. Let me read Psalm 51, verses 1 to 4, and then at verse 7. As the psalmist says, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin are always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Cleanse me with hyssop and I'll be clean. Wash me and I'll be whiter than snow." Here is a man, you see, who has grasped what he looks like to God, who has grasped how his sin, his wrongdoing defiles him. He knows that what he's done is evil in God's sight. He knows that God's judgment upon him is fair and just. He knows that his whole being is sinful, that he falls far short of God's standards. However hard he tries to live a good life, he cannot do it. And so he cries out for cleansing, that he'd be washed. And so you see, back in John chapter 13, what is it that Jesus is demonstrating as he goes around each disciple, one by one, washing their feet? Well, if they're to be clean in God's sight, if they're to be forgiven, then Jesus must wash away their sin. It's a wonderful visual aid of what Jesus achieved through his death upon the cross. He bore in himself God's punishment for sin, such that we might be forgiven and right with God, both in this life now, but also wonderfully in the next as well. The death of Jesus stands at the heart of authentic Christianity, the death of Jesus in the service of others. But then secondly, the disciples of Jesus in the service of others. Let's read on, verse 12. "When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. 'Do you understand what I've done for you?' he asked them. 'You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him." Notice, you see, how the death of Jesus on the cross then becomes a model or pattern for all Christian discipleship. The Christian life is to be marked by humble service. The mark of Jesus himself is now to mark how Christians relate both to one another and also to the world around. Did you notice that in verse 14, Jesus says, "You also ought to wash one another's feet"? You see, the Christian is someone who actively and consciously lowers themselves in the service of others. Now, I don't need to tell you that is completely countercultural, isn't it? And no more so in the city. I mean, just think of your office. Most workplaces, it's all too obvious, isn't it? It's exactly where people are on the pecking order. Whether you have a desk, whether you have an office, what kind of office you have, whether you have a view, all those sorts of things. You see, what is the proof, according to Jesus, that someone has been forgiven by Jesus? A lifestyle marked by the humble service of others. Now, let's not get Jesus wrong. This is not getting to heaven by good works. We've already seen in verse 8 that is impossible. The only way any of us can get to heaven is by having our sins washed away by Jesus. But once we've understood that Jesus died for us, then the hallmark of that understanding, the hallmark that we have been forgiven by Jesus, will be a lifestyle of serving others. Is Christianity good for Britain? Or the teaching of the Bible shapes the Magna Carta, celebrating its 800th anniversary this year. And in particular, the idea that rulers are to serve. Because you see, they rule by grace rather than by might. This led to the values of justice, peace, care for the poor and needy. Is Christianity good for Britain? Michael Gove, writing in The Spectator in the spring, described Christians like this, as the kind of people who built our civilization, founded our democracies, developed our modern ideas of rights and justice, ended slavery, established universal education, and who are in the forefront of the fight against poverty, prejudice, and ignorance. He went on, the contrast between the Christianity I see our culture belittle and the Christianity I see our culture benefit from daily could not be greater. And the contrast with what our society has become and increasingly is becoming could not be more striking. In his recent book with the title Selfish Whining Monkeys, Rod Liddell explains how the post-war baby boomer generation abandoned a commitment to the common good of society as a whole in favour of self-indulgent individualism and consumerism. See, it's not just that Christianity is good for Britain, it's that secularism combined with individualism and consumerism is bad. Now, I could finish there, but I guess if we were simply to finish there, it might be possible to leave this lunchtime thinking, well, look, I'll take the ethics. I like the morality, the ethics of serving others. That's what Britain needs. I'll have that kind of Christianity. But notice again, will you, that Jesus says that isn't Christianity at all. Look back to verse 8. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. Peter appalled at the thought that Jesus should stoop so low to wash his feet. But look again at Jesus' reply. Unless I wash you, you have no part with me. To reject the forgiveness that Jesus offers is to reject Jesus. You see, a Christian is not simply someone who, I think as is so often thought, someone who has a moral compass or a moral framework. Because of course everyone has some kind of moral compass or moral framework. A Christian is not someone who says, I'm a moral, upright person, a self-righteous person who wants to impose my morality on everyone else. No, Jesus hated that kind of self-righteousness. Rather, someone who says, I'm a moral failure. I am naturally self-centered. I naturally go my way, not God's way. My moral compass is all over the place. And so he turns to Jesus Christ in repentance and faith, knowing that because of his death on the cross, he offers forgiveness and sins washed away. And Jesus says, if you won't do that, you can have no part with me. You don't belong to me. Now, it may well be that you're here this lunchtime and you've never done that. You've never really grasped for yourself the forgiveness that Jesus Christ offers. In which case, can I encourage you to investigate the claims of Jesus Christ for yourself? Do come back to one of these Tuesday lunchtime services. We're here every Tuesday lunchtime through the year. Alternatively, if you'd like to take away something to read as well, then do pick up one of these little booklets which you'll find just by the door as you leave The Real Jesus. For those who have put their trust in Jesus, I hope you can see again how wonderful that is and the terrific assurance that we can have of forgiveness in him, the one who came to serve. But also to see that a life of serving others in response to Jesus' service of us is a life which honours Jesus. Let's have a few moments for reflection and then I'll hand over to Philip.